Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Allied Expeditionary Force. You are about to embark upon the Great Crusade, toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you.
On the eve of this great adventure, I send my best wishes to every soldier in the Allied keep.
The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark on the Great Crusade, toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hope and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well trained, well, that's debatable, well equipped, and battle hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940 and 41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war, and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking. My chest is feeling a little bit fuller.
I'm stirred. That was, of course, General Dwight D. Eisenhower, Supreme Allied Commander.
Could have been in the room.
It is very much like he's in the room. Welcome to Second World War Pod, WW2 Pod. We have ways of making you talk.
With D-Day me, 80 special.
D-Day 80 special with me, Al Murray, and James Holland. There was James Holland, by the way, doing that extraordinary
rendition.
Primary Colours rendition of Ike there. I like Ike.
I love Ike. Everyone likes Ike. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, he's smoking four packs a day, so he's carrying some of the stress with him.
I liked Phil. I was giving a bit of gravel.
So today, on this episode, episode 3, D-Day the beginning, we've laid out the sclerotic, chaotic, inward-looking, collapsed, intriguing, internecine situation on the German side. And then
the tidy, organised.
Well, collegiate, I think is
I think that's absolutely the right word.
Collegiate, delegated, but also great big railroads of decisions, deep planning decisions that not last minute changes. What the Allies are going to do is a great big set piece thing, because the only way in the end you can improvise is if you know what your set piece is.
Yes.
The Germans have no strategy.
You need your base.
You need your base. You need your strategy. You need your aim. The Germans have no aim other than push the enemy back into the sea.
Ranting and raving. Spittle.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
What will that achieve apart from winning the war so we can destroy Bolshevism? There's no quality. Obviously, we've just had Ike's inspirational speech there, but the quality of strategic thinking on the Allied side here is on a completely different planet. The German quality of strategic thinking. There is no German strategic. What else are the Germans concerning themselves with in the summer of 1944? Hungary, murdering Jews in Hungary.
May 1944.
That's what they've got. Yeah, the month before Overlord. That's what Hitler and his goons have got their eye on. Their war on European
Jewry. His despicable regime of Nazi lackeys.
Yeah, exactly. They're not thinking, okay, how do we actually practically deal with the prospect? And we talked in the last episode that the Germans know it's coming. They know there's going to be invasion. It's the strategic logic of the way the war's turning means that there will be invasion. It also suggests that means you've lost. And obviously, you know, one of the sort of totemistic things that happens on the morning of June the 6th when D-Day comes, postponed by a day, which we'll get to, is that no one wakes Hitler up with the bad news.
Der Boss.
Exactly. Der Chef. Wacken Sie up, or whatever it is. But you know what I mean? And there's a sort of, in a peculiar way, there's an absence of emergency about the German situation.
Amazing.
Anyway, and the German situation is, as the countdown to...
Yeah, so we're now at the very end of May, beginning of June.
Why June the 5th? Why is June the 5th? It's moonlight.
Moonlight and tides.
And it's Allied doctrine that you put your soldiers down basically at first light or just before.
Yeah, so the whole point about this is that you want to be able to use offshore naval guns to destroy targets.
Yep.
And to do that, you need to be able to see them. And you also want to bring your air forces, your overwhelming air forces to bear, and they need to be able to see their targets too. Because although they can operate blind, they can't really.
So you're putting guys on the beaches kind of at first light, which necessarily means your parachute forces have to land at night.
Exactly that.
And
Because they've got to come in first.
If they're going to tidy up the flanks and knock out guns and all the sort of stuff that they're going to do and seize nodal points, that has to be done at night.
Right. So you also want to have it where the tide is sufficiently far out that you can see the beach obstacles.
Yeah.
So you can see them.
Yeah.
Get
so
around.
That means actually once you get your slide rule out and you work out when these things all coincide, it's like an eclipse, isn't it? The things all have to line up. Planets have to align.
It's early morning rather than first light. First dawn is at 5:15 a.m.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But this means it's probably going to be June 5th if it's going to happen this summer.
Yeah.
The next cycle is
20th of June.
So Rommel bets on,
well, because the weather's really bad.
Right. Yeah. Well, General Marx has said that they're going to go to church Sunday, the 4th. They're going to, it's Marx, isn't it?
Eric Marx.
Which means tomorrow morning, it'll be Monday morning, Monday the 5th.
Yes, but he says that the week before.
Yeah.
When it's blazing sunshine.
Yeah.
Because there is the weather in May 1944 is absolutely glorious.
Yeah.
It's completely lovely. It's really hot, really gorgeous, and it just starts to turn.
And this
on the
is
3rd
a big part
of
the Allied planning is that they're expecting good weather in June because you get good weather in June in Northwest Europe, in France. And
that's the analog algorithm.
Yeah, exactly. And the enemy gets the vote, but the weather also
possibly gets a vote.
Has a role to play in all this. So Rommel picks the 20th of June, and he goes to see Hitler.
But by the time he makes that decision on the 3rd of June, the weather's turned.
Yeah.
So he thinks, you know.
Yeah, fair enough. But he's also...
But it's very, very careless because he's away at the start of the Battle of Alamein. All these people,
well,
you know, Sonder, everyone.
That's where I was going. That's where I was going exactly with this. He's satisfied from what the intelligence he has that the Allies are just not going to, they're not going to bother.
He shouldn't be.
No, of course he shouldn't. But he goes to see his wife for her birthday.
Because the idea that he doesn't know that a French Maquis commander has been captured on the 1st of June and interrogated and reveals that the invasion is any day, which he does. That should make him... But the reason he goes is because he's still trying to persuade Hitler to give him command of all the
Because they
division.
Haven't made a decision.
Well, they made a decision.
Well, they've made a proper decision.
But if he's made one decision, he's going to make a different decision. That's what he's hoping to do.
Yeah, because they all know he changes his mind, just like that.
Yeah.
But he's buying shoes for his wife in Paris.
But he's only going to see Lucy for her belated 50th birthday party because he wants to go and lobby Hitler. If he wasn't going to lobby Hitler, he wouldn't have gone to see Lucy.
352 Division are put on general alert by General Kreis, but he needs higher authority for that. Marx agrees to
it. Who's the 84 Corps commander?
Next guy up, but that request is then turned down. So no one's allowed. So not only are they not making decisions, no one's allowed to make decisions.
Yeah, so you see, if that was me in 1940, that'd be no problem whatsoever. Yeah. But it's not. It's 1944 now.
Kreis cheats and does war games.
There's mass war games for 7th Army planned for the 5th of June. So he uses that as an excuse to put them all on alert.
But
if anyone quibbles with him, he can just say, well, we're wargaming.
But still...
It's a ridiculous thing.
It's all really, really lame, isn't it?
It's absolutely rubbish.
Yeah. And there's a German spy in Turkey called...
Eliza Basner.
Cicero.
Yeah.
Who's the valet to the British ambassador in Ankara. I mean, what on earth's happened there? What are the Foreign Office doing? And that gives away the codename Overlord. That's in a, like, trivia category with the crossword clues that are the names of the beach. Whatever. That's a nothing story. How many words are there in the English language? The words are going to crop up in crosswords. 27th of May, Hitler tells the Japanese ambassador...
This is absolutely brilliant. This is so funny.
Yeah, he says that the Allied invasion is imminent. He also tells him there will be diversionary operations in Norway, Normandy, and possibly Britain before the main invasion in the Pas-de-Calais. And that's fortitude. Right there.
It is fortitude right there, but it's also covering all bases.
Yeah, he's basically saying.
So I won't be wrong because one bit of this will be right.
That's very Hitler, isn't it?
Very Hitler.
Here are five possibilities.
I'm right.
Four possibilities. Turns out I'm right. And then on the afternoon of June the 5th.
Obi West, which is von Rundstedt in the Hotel Georges V or wherever he is.
The invasion will be somewhere between the Scheldt and Normandy.
Brilliant. Genius. I mean, that's just amazing, isn't it? But no immediate prospect of
No immediate prospect. I mean, that's the
whole of southern England is by the 5th of June. They're all at sea.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't know.
Well, the 5th of June, that afternoon, it's meant to have happened already.
They've been in, most of them have been in ships since the 1st or 2nd of June.
Yeah.
They don't know.
Right.
So that's a German situation, which is basically, we know jack shit.
Yeah. Right, so what are the Allies up to? Well, I mean, are the Allies offering any clues as to their possible intentions? This is the other thing here. I mean, all that air activity, you know, I know...
Well,
I know
we've been talking about it in our Mighty episodes, but we can't not talk about the
Allies. I know, that one of the things they do is they make sure they attack all of northern France so the Germans can't pick a target. But surely...
You can narrow it down pretty easily by looking at previous Allied patterns of amphibious invasions, which and the emphasis they put on close air support of an invasion.
Yeah.
And that tells you where it's going to be.
Well,
and it will be clearly
Normandy.
Almost certainly. It's not going to be further south.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be much further north. It's going to be either side of the.
Well,
same.
And one of the advantages of Normandy, of course, is that. It's that little bit further from Germany. So if the Germans are going to bring stuff up, it's that little bit more difficult.
Never thought of that, but that's a fair point.
And Pas-de-Calais is that much closer to Germany. Mm. And so you know, the strategic elastic, the strategic dynamic, the Clausewitzian idea that, you know, the shorter your supply lines, the easier it is for you to fight. If you're drawing the Germans all the way over to Normandy, it's that extra...
It's 100 miles to Caen from La Roche-Guyon.
Exactly.
Rommel's headquarters on the Seine.
Exactly.
It's 280 miles from Caen, from Calais.
Exactly. And that just means getting fuel, getting ammunition, getting people, getting materiel to Normandy is that much more difficult, whereas it's essentially the same challenge for the British across the Channel. The Straits of Dover are so small, if you're going Dover-Calais, the Luftwaffe, if it does show up... And again, it's closer to Germany, so it's more likely to be able to, and likely to have more of an effect because it's a smaller battle space. It's got to be Normandy. I mean, this is the thing. And if it's obvious to me, stand-up comedian.
It sort of is obvious to Rommel, but he can't persuade anyone. And this is his whole point about the kind of, you know, use of the mobile divisions. So the Allied air plan massively accelerates into May with the transportation plan, which we talked about on the 8th Air Force episode. Chattanooga Choo Choo is the plan of the 21st, 22nd of May to destroy as many locomotives in motion as they possibly can. 91 are destroyed on the 21st of May. The night of the 19th, 20th of May, Bomber Command hits the marshalling yards of Boulogne, Orléans, Amiens, Tours and Le Mans. So this is all much closer to the bridgehead.
That's all around. You know,
all around,
you look on a map, that's
your
all
hinge,
around it.
Yep. 22nd, 23rd of May, Orléans, Le Mans hit again. 25th of May, 8th Air Force hits Seine bridges and enemy airfields.
I wonder if there's an Allies Villette.
Yes.
But
you could be isolating, the Pas-de-Calais from the south.
You could be.
Aachen is also hammered, important rail hub.
Yeah.
197,000 tons of bombs dropped on France in the 9 weeks leading up to D-Day. Put that in comparison, 18,000 tons dropped on London in the entire Blitz.
Okay.
Casualties in France.
France,
you know,
this is one
of the big fears of Churchill. He's very worried about it. Yeah. It's, you know, it's why he's got sort of doubts about the whole operation.
Yeah.
712 French civilians are killed in March, 5,144 in April.
And almost twice as many in May, nearly 10,000.
Yeah, 9,800. But that tells you everything you need to know about the acceleration of the of the transportation plan. But, you know, that comes at a massive cost. Between the 1st of April and 5th of June 1944, Allies lose 12,000 aircrew.
You know, when you look at the final scores for the Overlord battle, the sheer number of aircrew lost on the Allied side is gigantic. It's a number that competes with land troops, actually. And that's really, really, it's really, really striking. So you may
in
well...
In terms of KIA, yes.
Yeah, yeah, in terms of KIA. You may well have air supremacy, or air superiority bordering on supremacy, but it costs, even when it's going well, you're losing air crews. Like that. I mean, first of April to the 5th of June, 12,000 aircrew killed.
I mean, the key thing, though, is that by the 28th of May, they have this huge air battle.
Yeah.
On the 28th of May, in which 78 German aircraft are shot down or severely damaged for the loss of 9 Allied planes. And the closest airfield to Normandy on that day is 500 miles. So they've done it.
They've done it.
And that's also the same day that Hitler announces that the ME-262 jet is going to be a bomber, not a fighter interceptor.
He's got his eye on the ball.
So they're also doing, as well as the transportation town, they're doing all the noble sites, which is the V1s, V2s.
Yeah.
And also, 123 wing of the RAF is focusing on knocking out the radar stations, and these are the Typhoons.
Yeah.
They're rocket-firing Typhoons and cannons, and they knock out 76 of 92 radar stations along the Atlantic coast. Absolutely amazing, including all the Mammoth and Wassermann radars, which are the most sophisticated radars that the Germans have at this point. These are the kind of 360 rotating ones. And that means that on the entire Atlantic coast, German radar is at only 5% efficiency.
And being relentlessly spoofed as well, what's left of it.
Yeah, completely. So, and compare that again with 1940, you know, the total inability of the Luftwaffe to destroy the radar.
Yeah, to shut down the radars,
But our old friend Air Chief Marshal Sir Trafford Leigh Mallory is having the heebie-jeebies because the intelligence arrives...
Don't look for an episode about him. There isn't one.
There isn't one. intelligence has arrived that Fallschirmjäger Regiment 6 has arrived into the Cotentin Peninsula. This is von der Heiters that we talked about in the first episode. And also the 91st Luftlander Division, which is an anti-airborne division. It's specifically designed to do that. It doesn't mean it's very well trained or very well equipped, but they are there. And they are now in that southern bit of the Cotentin Peninsula. And also the intelligence arrives that the 352nd Infantry Division has now moved up near the coast. And the plan has been, is for the 101st, and this is the only bit the plan that changes, 101st and 82nd Airborne to be landed quite far apart. So the idea was the 82nd Airborne is on the western side of the Cotentin Peninsula.
Yeah, and you cut the whole peninsula off.
And you cut the whole peninsula off. But this is scrapped on the 26th of May on the basis of this information. So the 82nd Airborne is given the Murderer Valley, both sides, to secure that.
Yeah.
And that ridge line that involves the San Mera Gleas with its nodal point and its key crossroads and passing point of the railway and main road up to Cherbourg. And then the 101st will basically do the covering of the Utah beach landings where 4th Infantry Division is due to land. But Leigh Mallory wants the whole thing scrapped. And the problem is that while the paratroopers, the airborne troops, don't actually fall under his command.
The planes do.
The nine troop carrier command does. And the plan is for 915 of these C-47s to cross the peninsula east-west at 1,000 feet off the deck. And that's exactly where the 91st Luftlander Division is.
Yeah.
And the problem with the C-47s is they're not designed as combat aircraft. They haven't got any armor. They haven't got any armor. And they don't even have self-sealing tanks. So Leigh Mallory is concerned it's going to be a slaughter. And so he says this to Bradley, and Bradley can say, get back in your box.
Yeah.
He says this to Maxwell Taylor, who's the commander of the 101st, and to Murphy Ridgway, who's commander of the 82nd. And both of them just absolutely dismiss his concerns. So he then writes to Eisenhower.
I hesitate to increase your problems at the present difficult time, but I feel I should be failing in my duty to you if I did not let you know that I was very unhappy about the US airborne operations as now planned.
And Ike basically says, yeah, whatever, you know, thanks for your concerns. However, a strong airborne attack in the region indicated is essential to the whole operation, and it must go on. It is particularly important that air and ground troops involved in the operation be not needlessly depressed. Like all of the rest of the soldiers, they must understand that they have a tough job to do, but be fired with determination to get it done. In other words, stop.
Now's not the time, mate.
Now's not the time.
However, I mean, he's right.
isn't he? The cutting off the whole Cotentin Peninsula is beyond their...
So they've adjusted it.
That's fine. I mean, and it's interesting that they are able, although...
Because it doesn't involve the Navy.
Of course.
You just put them in a plane, just say, right, we're not going to land there, we're going to land somewhere else. But you wouldn't be able to do that if it was... You wouldn't be able to change the Utah plan.
Just as well they didn't do that. Landing at night, before we even get into whether they're scattered by the weather and all that, of which there are differing opinions, landing at night is difficult, it's hard... And it complicates things.
One thing the Germans have done is they have flooded every bit of river that they possibly can, opened the sluice gates, all that kind of stuff. So the Murderer Valley is a kind of sort of boggy morass now. But back in the UK, I mean, all the invasion troops are ready. There's going to be 155,000 of them.
Yep.
You know, 132,000, 133,000 troops landed by sea.
Yep.
22,000 landed by air. Stores have been built up. The whole of southern England is one vast camp of widened roads.
There's
and
that chocolate bar concrete absolutely everywhere that Steve, Stephen Fisher is absolutely fascinating.
This has been laid down on all these little...
And roads built in the Nude Forest so you can park trucks and hide in the...
And between Broadchalk and Wilton,
I mean,
where I live.
Yeah, if you go for a walk in the New Forest, you'd suddenly come across these hard stand, basically, concrete platforms
all over the place.
This is stuff that's been going back the year previously.
Yep.
So preparing for this massive embarkation. There's obviously a blood drive on, getting people to donate blood. There's, there's all this stuff that's deep planning, deep preparation. Yep. Right. So,
very end of May, all the troops are moved to these camps right on the coast where you're no longer allowed out. No more trips to the pub, anything. Yep. You are now in to the invasion is goodbye. Yep. To say to all your loved ones, that's it. Yep. These are known as sausages. They're all there. The whole of the southern coast, literally every single port cove has been converted with your Cadbury's chocolate concrete.
Yeah.
You know, there's landing craft allocated. Everyone is good to go. People are starting to load up on the 1st, 2nd of June. It's all happening. It's all kicking off.
We've touched on it two or three times already. The weather.
Yeah. I'm absolutely determined to get my friend Simon Keeling to come and do
a proper... Okay, so look forward to that episode when it comes, ladies and gentlemen.
However...
But the pricey is, the weather isn't what people had expected or hoped for.
No.
May has been perfect. June is quickly going sour. And the Allies have the advantage of, because they control the Atlantic, they have weather information coming all the way across the Atlantic in a way that the Germans now don't. The Germans don't have a big weather picture to look at in the way that the Allies do. And there's disagreement, isn't there, within the Allied establishment about the weather.
So the interesting thing is Group Captain James Stagg, who's always quoted in this because he wrote an autobiography about
it.
But he's not actually a meteorologist.
What?
No.
Hold on. I mean, I know we're not really in this sort of myth.
He's a geologist.
I mean, welcome to We Have Ways to Make You Talk, Mythbusters.
Mythbusters.
We've just bust a myth for you there.
No.
So he's a geologist.
He's a geologist. He's not a meteorologist.
How's he ended up in that job then?
Because he has. He's
clever.
He's clever, and he is.
How old is Stagg at this point?
38.
Right. Okay. But 40. he's a clever man. And
he's a good guy. Yeah. You know, he's a Scot. He's a decent fellow. He's an academic in civilian life. But he is he's the man overall in charge of combined teams. And obviously, the Air Ministry have their own meteorologists, and the US Strategic Air Forces under SPOTS have their own meteorologists. And they're all suddenly brought together under the overall charge of Group Captain James Stagg.
Right.
But there are two. The British team is head up by a Norwegian called Sverre Pettersen.
Yeah.
And he is a kind of, you know, just look at the existing data kind of guy. And the Americans have this kind of rather maverick figure called Dr. Irving Crick.
Oh, come on. I mean, sometimes Irving the Americans Crick. Have names that are straight out of, you know...
Comics.
Too on the nose for a novel.
I'm Dr. Irving Crick. I'm here to look at your weather.
I'm meteorologist.
I'm the meteorologist. The maverick meteorologist Irving Crick is here to see you, sir.
So he's looking at patterns. And Pettersen is just looking at what's in front of his nose.
Right, okay.
The problem is that forecasting. It is predicting, and you are second guessing how these movements, which are reported, are going to come in. Obviously, you've got zillions of weather stations in Ireland and all the rest of it, but you've only got limited ones from the Azores and out at sea in the Atlantic.
Yep.
And things can change. It's not you don't have GPS, you don't have satellites reporting, you know, so you are just predicting. And
they're still much better informed than the Germans, though, right?
Yeah, they are. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's, you know, it's not the kind of, you know, it's not even precise today.
No.
With all the stuff you've got, it's less precise then. On the 1st of June, it appears that there is storms appealing. So it's
sort of Michael Fish weather forecasting.
Yeah.
These magnets,
for those who don't know, 1987.
Off the thing.
1987.
the great storm.
There will not be a storm.
There will not be a hurricane tonight, yeah.
So on the 1st of June, Pettersson predicts 10 tenth cloud and force 5 by Monday the 5th of June. And actually on this, Crick completely agrees. There's no big debate about this. Stagg warns the commanders on the 2nd of June. So this is the chiefs and Vice and Han and all the rest of it. 9:30 p.m. on the 3rd of June, Stagg comes into the library at Southwark House, just south of Portsmouth, where they're all based, where where the planning is, and where's the huge great map on the wall and all the rest of it of the invasion round.
Yeah,
all that. And he warns them that his fears of the previous day are looking really likely, that it's looking like a really bad situation. And the discussions on the implications of this continue until 11 p.m. And Stagg is told to go back and then return for a briefing at 4:15 on Sunday the 4th of June. And as he goes away, Tedder goes, "Pleasant dreams, Stagg."
Oh, it's awful.
No, it's brilliant.
No, it's awful.
It's brilliant.
It's like, hey, no pressure, man. It's awful.
No, it's absolutely brilliant.
No, I don't like it. I know you like it, but I don't like it.
I think what that's showing is that I'm going to keep, you know, I'm Deputy Supreme Allied Commander, I'm keeping calm on this.
Yeah.
Crick now believes that a ridge of high pressure from the Azores is going to keep the worst of the storm away from the Normandy coast.
Yeah.
On the 5th. So Crick's stick with it. Pessim feels that is going to be too much and that it won't clear in time on the more early hours of the 5th of June.
Yeah.
Stagg just instinctively trusts Pettersson more than Crick because Crick's American and slightly maverick, and Pettersson's a guy he's been working with for a lot longer. So the 4th of June, Sunday the 4th of June, Stagg turns up at 4:15 a.m. into the library at Southwark House, says the weather still looks bad. And Eisenhower feels that the full support of the Air Forces is what's essential. So they're less concerned about the mocking around of the landing craft
on a force five.
They're much more concerned about the 10-10s cloud.
Yeah.
That's the real...
Well, and that's the lesson of the campaign in Italy that winter, is that when you don't have the air power, it levels things out for the defender. Yeah.
So Stagg is predicting that the high pressure that follows the low pressure, because you get low pressure, then you always get a kind of a drop off of wind and you know the sky clears in the immediate aftermath before it the next round of low pressure kind of swirls in. And he thinks it'll be too late, but thinks that there is this little window, this little ridge of high pressure which is bulging across, and it is predicted to hit the Normandy coastline and the Channel on the early hour, you know, overnight on the 5th, 6th of June. This is a total punt.
Right.
This is the bit. When we get Simon Keating on, he can explain this in much better detail. But there is no reason why that would stay there. That, you know, it could very easily disappear off into the North Sea.
Right, okay.
It really could. There's, you know, that is just an absolute punt that will happen. So Crick is very much in favour of just sticking to the existing plan because they're already there and there's not going to be much in it. Forces J and S, which is for Juno Beach and Sword Beach, they're already on their way. They've got to be recalled. Eisenhower makes the decision to postpone for 24 hours, which is a massive call.
Yeah, it's huge, isn't it?
Because of morale and issues and people being out at sea and all the rest of it. So Sunday night, 4th of June, 9 p.m, Stagg reports again to the commanders in the library. It's like, we postponed 24 hours. What's it looking like for the 6th now? And Stagg says, well, I think, you know, I still think we're going to get that little window of high pressure.
Yeah.
But he doesn't really know. But he's got to say something. Pettersson is thinking that it will be okay. Crick is still kind of thinking, should have gone on the 5th.
Are we saying the war could have ended a whole day earlier?
It could have done a whole day earlier. and at the time, outside, it is now clear skies, the wind has dropped, there's no rain whatsoever, it's 3 a.m.
Yeah.
So that's in Portsmouth.
It could have gone on the 5th.
What it would have meant a delay by an hour and a half of the 6th Air Ball.
I mean, the thing is what happens to them anyway in terms of landing coherently.
So it could have done on the 5th.
It could have gone on the 5th, yeah.
Anyway, they made the call.
You never know. Maybe 500 people had met the rendezvous for the Mayville battery. It would have gone differently on a different night. Who knows?
Anyway, 4:15 a.m. It is decision time on the 5th of June. They've either got to go or they've got to cancel. And if they cancel, they're not doing it again until the 20th. So Stagg is still reasonably sure there'll be a window. He presents them and says, "I think so." You know, but I mean, it's massive deep breath. And so Eisenhower says, well, what does everyone think? And one goes, well, I think we should go.
Yeah.
So does Beadle Smith, so does Ramsey, so does Tedder. I mean, inevitably, Lee Mallory is still sort of going, oh, I don't know, I'm worried. But the decision rests with Eisenhower. So he sits in his chair, rubs his face with his hands, sat in that very chair, looks up and goes, okay, let's go.
And we're going to go to a break. Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. So Ike has just said, let's go.
To go.
They go. So
they're out at sea.
Quarter past 10, 22:15 hours, Monday the 5th of June.
Oberstleutnant Helmut Meyer.
Who's the radio interception guy for German 15th Army and his team. And the Germans haven't been bad at radio interception because very often the British are extremely slack with wireless security throughout the war. They pick up...
Someone's heart is languishing
It's a BBC code signal. It's a BBC code signal to the resistance. It's not. It's a thing on open communications. He passes that straight up. That's the invasion is coming message that the BBC transmit for the resistance. He tells Rommel, headquarters.
Yeah,
Rommel's not there, and up to OB West for Rundstedt, and on to the German General Staff.
But it's not passed on to 7th Army.
What?
And also,
I mean,
Oberst Wilhelm Meyer Detring, who's the head of intelligence at OB West, is away on leave.
But you know what? People are going to be away on leave. I mean,
not Army Group Commanders.
Army Group Commanders being away on leave. It's the summer. When else are they? What else is going to happen?
You should be on high alert. No one should be on leave then.
I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
No, it's bonkers, but not sort of important people like that. Yeah. 23:40, German radar station on Guernsey picks up airborne forces crossing the channel. Yeah. This is reported to 84 Corps, but again, fobbed off by a duty officer. At 7 minutes past midnight on the 6th of June, we're now on D-Day the 6th of June, German sentries spot low-lying aircraft north of Carentan.
US pathfinders land at 10 minutes past midnight, and they're coming in to mark out drop zones. Parachute soldiers coming in the next few minutes. Fallschirmjäger 6 at 11 minutes past midnight reports enemy paratroopers.
And at 16 minutes past, this is an exciting one. This is it.
Yes, the first of three British gliders, piloted by Jim Woolwock, lands landed in Sicily the year before and had been...
miles off.
But selected for this and trained for this, and real heavy focus on him as a lead pilot. To capture the bridge at Benneville, so they send six gliders for the pair of bridges on the Conn Canal on the Orne River, which we talked about in the previous episode, which drop perpendicular from the sea down to Conn, kind of in a straight line in parallel with each other. The men are D Company, the Oxenbucks, led by Major John Howard, who's an ex-cop, and they hurry out and they take the bridge. They take the bridge within minutes.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. Yeah. And it's amazing because Jim Woolworth, in the first lead glider, lands, literally just nudges the wire.
He's on the wire.
Around the little sort of gun position. Yeah. There's a sort of an anti-aircraft cannon right on that eastern side of Pegasus Bridge.
Yeah.
Out they all jump, arms locked, on the thing. Yeah. You're crash landing a glider. I mean, it's an insane way to come into battle.
And on those
they jump out.
But on those gliders, there's assault boats in case the bridge has been blown. There's sappers to make sure that there aren't explosives on the bridge. The expectation is that they will not succeed.
Yes, that is a really important point.
There are men from 8 Para, who are the parachutists who land in a minute to relieve them, who are jumping with inflatables in their kit bags to go paddle across the Conn Canal, the Orne River, because the expectation is this is going to fail. They aren't going to, although they've trained up to the eyeballs and they've practiced, they don't expect to take the bridges. All these redundancies built into...
It's amazing, isn't it?
It's absolutely amazing. And there's an episode by the Colonel, my father.
496.
Episode 496, which details the full planning around that, around taking those bridges and then the further bridging, because once you've got those secured those water obstacles, the thing to do is stick a load of bridges on them so that you can invest the high ground on the Breville Ridge. And bridges landing on Sword Beach that morning in bits and pieces in trucks.
It's absolutely amazing.
In scores of trucks.
They do secure it. And it's interesting because as they come in across the coast, the cord is cut.
Yeah.
They then glide to the south and cut back in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so you're actually arriving from the south. So you circle round 180 degrees and then glide in.
So if you watch The Longest Day, they come in the wrong way in the movie.
Yeah, that's interesting.
They come in off the coast.
John Howard kept a very detailed account of all this, and he said that when he was looking out from the glider, everything looked exactly as he thought it would, because they've just studied all these aerial photographs, every feature they've memorized.
And they ran a little film over a model.
Yeah.
They ran a camera over a model. And the
yeah.
pilots.
And it looks
able to watch the cine film.
Exactly the same. So yeah. It's all perfect done. Yeah. They storm out, take out the guys in the on the manning the gun, rush across the bridge.
We're also blasé about the. They think it's parts of a bomber crashing. Being shot down and crashing, the sound of the gliders landing. And there's a blasé attitude, because obviously every night there's stuff. I mean, this is, you know, we talked about all these people not taking it seriously, but every night there's stuff. The French coast has been attacked every night for months. Mm. So every night there's alarms and excursions. So little wonder. But this, after all, this is the only part of the airborne, six airborne, Operation Tonga that goes according to plan, actually as planned, this one bit. The Merville Battery, which is just up the road, which is overlooking Sword Beach on the high ground on the coast there. Yep, it's a gun battery.
But on the eastern side of the Orne.
On the eastern side of the Orne is bombed by some Lancasters. And then it all starts happening quite quickly.
So it's 17 minutes past midnight. Two of the three, well, all three land, but one of them lands a long way away.
Yeah.
But two land at the other bridge.
Horser Bridge, as it's called.
Horser Bridge.
Then the Pathfinders at 20 past, Pathfinders start dropping from 22nd Independent Parachute Company. And they're coming in with Rebecca and Eureka. It's the beacon system. Right. You set up a Eureka, and the Eureka is passive. So what you don't do is plonk a thing down that gives away where it is. You plonk a thing down that's listening for the aeroplane coming in and then goes, hello, I'm here, and directs in the parachutists to come. Problem with that, of course, is the Pathfinders have to land at the right place. They do. The weather is challenging. The nighttime drop is challenging. Things kind of unravel on the night, but I think there's an expectation that they will. James Hill, who's third Parachute Brigade commander, he says chaos will reign, expected to. Just crack on.
Meanwhile, we've had the first casualty, which is Lieutenant Dan Brotheridge. He's the first officer out. He's literally the first man out of the first glider.
Yeah.
Charges across the bridge, gets hit in the neck.
Yeah.
But he doesn't actually die until about 2:30 in the morning.
Right.
So he's not the first death, he is the first casualty.
Right.
And interestingly, his body is recovered from a Horser glider, I think the second one, and that's because it falls in a little dip below the thing, and that's obviously been turned into the first aid boat,
the
RAB.
His
wounded body is taken to there where the medical officer is trying to treat him. And so when his body's recovered, that is where it's recovered.
Same time, dummy paratroopers, Rupert's, are being dropped with the SAS. So
gramophones.
To distract the enemy. At half past midnight, Oberleutnant Brandenburger, who's with the 5th Battalion, the 125th Mechanized Infantry Regiment, says, I'm watching an airborne operation east of the Orne River. Hello?
Yeah.
A load of bomber command bombers come in and attack the anti-aircraft batteries around the
Conch. I mean, it really is. They thought of everything, haven't they?
It's Needlepoint, Carpiquet area. There's a big airfield at Carpiquet. Then you have the 4th French Paratroopers Battalion, 20-1 at 0040 hours.
He's the first Frenchman to be killed.
First Frenchman to be killed, Corporal Emile Bouetard.
He's arguably the first Allied soldier to be killed. Dan Brotheridge isn't dead.
Yeah. General Lieutenant Wilhelm Richter from 716 Infantry Division, the OC of that. He's getting reports of airborne landings. It's happening, right?
Yep.
50 at 0045.
Pointing in one direction.
Yeah. German reports of that there are more paratroopers. 101st Airborne start dropping at
48 minutes past midnight.
On Mission Albany in the Cotentin Peninsula. 5th Brigade of 6th Airborne Division. This is the parachute reinforcements to bolster the men at the bridges and also to start occupying the high ground, clearing around Rolville, the village of Rolville on the Breville Ridge. They start arriving, and they're commanded by
Brigadier
Nigel Poet.
Yep.
If you're the Germans, surely it's obvious it's happening by now, but
it might be a diversion.
The Kriegsmarine radar spots an important armada in the front of the Pas de Calais, which is a spoof.
This is 617 Squadron, the Dambusters. 617's
dropping window and radar reflectors and stuff, confusing everyone. German Sergeant Ludwig Förster discovers an Allied armada overlooking the Conville Draw on Omaha Beach. So now there's ships appearing. We've had the airborne landings, now there's ships.
Yeah, this is the minesweepers.
Yeah, clearing a path. More paratroopers, French paratroopers are dropping in Brittany, which I think's really interesting. Again,
this is the SAS,
so it's French SAS. Then all German troops under the command of 84 Corps from the Orne River to Saint-Malo are put on alert. The Germans are getting the message.
You know, it's all happening thick and fast. Yeah. 1 minute later, 716th German Infantry Division warns Marks, enemy in the Cotentin. You know, 121, Pathfinders of the 2nd Airborne Division start jumping over Normandy and the Cotentin in their drop zones N, O, and T. which is sort of, you know, either side of the river, Murderay.
Then at 1:30,
Fatty General Dolman.
7th Army Commander. Even Fatty Dolman can see something's up. Yep. He orders a general alert. 10 minutes later, 0140, 101st Airborne is
They're all down.
They're all on the ground. 5 minutes later, General Marks receives new information saying that there are paratroopers between Saint-Marie-de-Mont and Saint-Marie-Glise.
Yep. So Saint-Marie-de-Mont is about, you know, it's about 4 or 5 miles difference. Yep. Just to the kind of southwest of Saint-Marie-Glise, but it's all in that neck of the wood, base of it. And it's interesting, isn't it? You know, because just a little bit later, Naval West Group Chief of Operations for the Kriegsmarine, Admiral Karl Hoffmann, summons various staffs following the accumulation of alarming reports and sends the following message to Germany. Report to the headquarters of the Führer that it is the invasion.
Man on the ground thinks it's so.
But, you know, are they listening?
Well, is he awake? Are they going to wake him up? 0151, 82nd Airborne Division starts landing.
Yep. So a little bit behind 101st.
Yeah.
And that's because 101st are going first across
Gotentin. Yeah, yeah.
So they're going further east, so you want to get them in
there. And these airstreams have to all be carefully coordinated, not all crash into each other and all that sort of stuff. And they're going out into the Atlantic, aren't they, and then coming back in, or out to the far end of the English Channel and coming back in.
Yeah, they go round from the Channel Islands.
That's right, they dogleg round, don't they?
And amazingly, you know, at 5 to 2 a.m., 1,198 bombers of the United States 8th Air Force. That's when they take off. So they're operating at night.
Yes, they're operating at night. Isn't that interesting?
Yep.
2 o'clock in the morning, von Rundstedt is made aware of the alerts. So someone's gone in.
What does von Rundstedt say? Oh, leave me alone. I want to go back to sleep.
Duty officer places Hauptmann Wagemann, places a 21st German Armour Division on level 2 alert, which is a movement ability less than an hour and a half. Not level 1. Assume 1's the top, not 3. 5 minutes past 2, 1st Panzerjäger Company of 716th Infantry Regiment leaves Bieville to patrol along the Orne Canal in the direction of the Benneville and Ronville bridges, which are now full of paratroopers and glider soldiers. 5 minutes later, news reaches 716th
Richter,
Division.
General Richter.
Pegasus and Horsa bridges have been captured intact. So the Orne Canal and the Orne River are under British control, which means you can't get your panzers over them if you're trying to go in nice and close to where Sword Beach is going to be, to Wistrom. Full alert at 13 minutes past 2 in 84 Corps. There's a dawning on the Germans, but, I mean, could they do... I mean, the thing is, here's a question. This is a torrent of stuff happening. Is there anything they can do about this anyway, given the way they're set up?
Not really, because there's a sort of general lack of coordination and everything. Yeah. I mean, you know, I suppose the kind of biggest focus you could have is 84 Corps, you know, under Marks, try and kind of bypass Dolman as much as you possibly can, because he's just hopeless, which is essentially what happens. But you know, his mobile reserve along the coast is one of the regiments of the 352nd, which is a 3-regiment division, not a 2-division, two-regiment one. And that is the mobile reserve. But the mobile reserve is mobile through purloined French trucks and bicycles. You know, so he pretty quickly sends them off to go and intercept reports of the Operation Titanic, you know, the loudspeakers and the you know, and the Rupert's coming down, these dummy paratroopers, and sends them all off.
Yeah.
You know, they're nowhere near the coast. I mean, they're near the coast, but they're not that close. So they send them off on their bicycles to go and intercept that. You know, Marx, with all his experience, should have recognised that airborne troops are, you know, they're the harbingers of something bigger.
Yeah.
Because airborne troops don't operate in isolation.
Yeah, because they can't.
They need to be supporting. So don't chuck all your eggs in one basket and chase that one. Just keep calm, hold your nerve, and wait for the invasion.
I mean, the other thing with airborne troops is if you go back to them 3 days later, they'll have run out of ammunition and food.
Right. So he's, you know,
So you hold them up. Don't make them a focus of a main effort in this situation when something much bigger's on its way.
You know, he makes a catastrophic decision in sending his mobile reserve off that. And these guys, you know, they're cycling in the night, you know, around the back lanes of Normandy. I mean, it is absolutely hopeless. This is the elite 352nd.
Yeah.
Anyway, sort of fighting continues. You know, you've got all the 6th Airborne troops are now trying to organise themselves and get off to the various bridges over the River Dives, which they're trying to destroy, you remember from the last episode, just to prevent a kind of westward crossing of from 15th Army, hold the Breville Ridge, get across to Troarn and Rubaum and these places to destroy these 5 bridges, which they're all doing. And there's fighting going on around the Breville Ridge and all the rest of it. It's really, it's crazy. I mean, 7th Army by 3 o'clock is it's correctly identified the centre of the Allied airborne drops.
You can correctly identify it all you want. What are you going to do about it?
Yeah, well, exactly.
As you say, it must mean there's a sea landing coming.
Yeah, and by 3 o'clock, you know, the invasion force is off the coast.
Yeah.
They're starting to, you know, those who've been in transports are now getting into their LCAs and their Higgins boats. They're getting ready for this. You know, it's all building towards something pretty substantial.
I mean, this is the detail here I really love. Sergeant Ludwig Förster fires three white rockets from his WN-62 strongpoint near the Colville Draw at Omaha Beach to ask the offshore ships to identify themselves.
And do they? No.
Well, no, they don't. Well, they're going to pretty shortly by means of artillery.
Yes.
But I mean, there's a sort of... There's a charm in that, isn't there?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Well, I better check who they are.
Yeah, it's absolutely crazy. 3:20 a.m. General Windy Gale, commander of the 6th Airborne Division, British 6th Airborne Division. He's parachuted in.
I think he comes in the glider.
Oh, does he?
Yeah, I don't think. I think he's too old to.
Oh, is he? He glides in.
Anyway,
he comes in on Ronville, doesn't he? On the end zone.
But in the expectation that he's not going to really be able to do anything tonight, his attitude is: I need to be there. But we're going to have to let events proceed. I'm not here to command right now. I'm here to look at the state of things in the morning when the dust has settled. And that's his attitude, because he's also doing the thing of it's a very complicated plan, and he knows he can't do anything about it on the night.
Meanwhile, Lieutenant Colonel Terence Otway,
what a commander story this
of 9th Battalion.
Yeah.
9 para, 3:25 a.m. It's all been a bit of haywire. Their jump, it hasn't gone exactly where they think it's going to. He's supposed to have 635 men in his battalion. He only manages to muster 170.
Yeah. Well, some estimates are even lower. And they come to their rendezvous. There's a bunch of gliders that are meant to land on top of the on top of the battery, and the men in those gliders are wearing skull and crossbones luminous patches on their smocks so that they won't be killed by friendly fire is the big idea.
Right.
And they've got a flamethrower in the glider with them and all this sort of stuff. And they land in the wrong place. And there's a guy who's an ex-policeman who I met who interviewed about that. And he said, I'm only alive because the glider pilot landed in the wrong place. He said, if we landed on that battery, we'd all be dead.
Amazing. But they attack it. And they've got a tough one because they've got to attack it before the Lancasters come over and flatten it.
Yeah. And before the Navy starts shelling it at first light.
So they've got very, very little time.
Narrow margin.
So he's got 170 men or less. Yeah. Whatever he's got to take.
And so they do it. And they go, the Bangalore torpedo their way in through the wire. It's a great big firefight. At the end of it, 75 men are still standing.
Amazing.
Absolutely incredible. And then they move off and they find that it's not the heavy guns in the battery that they thought they were, but they then move on to their next objective. Also, you have 55 horses coming in 10 minutes later, bringing in guns, jeeps, field ambulance, explosives and all this sort of stuff. Because the way the British parachute battalions work is the battalions parachute their bayonets in, basically, and everyone else generally comes by glider. So the parachute in there, it's like they're parachuting the software and the hardware comes by glider is kind of the way the parachute battalions operate.
Yep.
The air landing battalions, which come tomorrow or come later on D-Day, that's glider-born soldiers in gliders. And the Ox and Bucksmen are the exception. This glider lift is stuff.
Yeah.
Stuff for the men to work it.
Yeah, and isn't that where the jeep with the medical supplies comes
Tim Rosevere purloins it, fills it with explosives and goes and blows up the bridge at Troarn. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah. It all works. I mean,
that is the most amazing thing, is that they blow up all the bridges they're supposed to and they hold on to all the bridges they're supposed to.
Yeah.
So the ones that they don't want blowing up don't get blown up.
And the ones that they
one of the reasons, actually, the interesting thing about Pegasus Bridge and Horse Bridge is one of the reasons they don't is because they've got kind of Ospitalian troops. And in the past, they've kind of said, whatever you do, don't blow out the bridge. And they come down and stand so they blow it up. You know, the explosives haven't been set underneath those bridges.
That's
so
right,
they're never going to blow up anyway.
Samuel Eglise is liberated by 4 o'clock in the morning. The American flag hoisted at the town hall.
Yep.
Love a bit of drama like that. Then American Waco gliders come in. And the American air landing effort, the glider effort, is also similarly kind of half done because they can't airlift everyone in on the night.
8 minutes past four, death of General Pratt,
who
was second in command of the US 101st Airborne Division.
Yes.
As depicted in Saving Private Ryan.
It's because they've armoured his glider and it's
too heavy.
It's too heavy, the pilot can't control it. Terrible business. This is all gaining momentum.
It is
the other thing. These soldiers aren't just landing, they're fighting successfully. By first light, by 10 past five, the first shots of naval artillery are coming from HMS Orion, which is a cruiser off Gold Beach. And the next phase is underway. And the airborne landings, although they have been dispersed and disrupted by the weather and by German counter-airborne effort in terms of flooding large chunks of the countryside and all that sort of stuff, they have been successful in securing their objectives generally.
I mean, the airborne drop isn't anything like as badly scattered as MIF would have it. Yeah. I mean, I think something like 75% are within 10 miles. Yeah. You know, over 50% are within 5 or something.
Yeah, relief is on hand.
Yes,
is the point. Dawn's at 5:15. Report at 20 past. Report transmitted by the 352nd Artillery Regiment to the staff of the 352nd Division. There's naval units coming. There's 29 ships, of which 4 are quite large.
Yeah,
and observed at a distance of 6 to 10 k. So well within, the guns are coming, and a number of landing craft in front of Port-en-Bessin is about 50. So the Germans now know airborne landings are one thing. This is happening now. The main thing's happening.
Yeah, and the amazing thing is at 5:25 a.m., 3 German gunboats are fleeing Wiesbaden and going down the Conn Canal and run straight into paratroopers, and they just get shot up and destroyed.
Absolutely amazing, that, isn't it? Like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
We'll go inland. Oh, no, they're inland. At 5:30, a Norwegian destroyer called the Svenna is sunk off Sword Beach by a German S-boat. So the Kriegsmarine fires 18 torpedoes out of Le Havre, so can still do something, but that's it, you know. And that's not unlike, because the Luftwaffe aren't completely absent on D-Day. They do pop up, but on a kind of similar level of seriousness, right?
And naval bombardment begins at 5:31.
Yes, so shit gets real if you're on the Normandy coast. Eastern Task Force warships open fire on the British and Canadian beaches, which are Gold, Juno and Sword. The LSIs, the landing ship infantries, a minute later drop anchor off Juno Beach.
5:35. 29 American amphibious DD Shermans of the 741st Tank Battalion are launched 6 kilometres off the coast. What are they thinking?
They got that wrong. All but 2 sink en route to the beach.
Whereas all but 2 get to the beach of the other one.
German guns.
Those 4 big guns on Longsimer.
Longsimer at 5:37 fire on US destroyers, USS Emmons and USS Arkansas. What's the proportion of American naval effort?
1,213, of which 932 are British.
Okay, so what? 4/5?
200.
So it's 4...
I think 200 are American.
Okay. 5/6 British to American naval effort.
Yeah. And a few French and Polish and Norwegian or so.
And the Navy there's naval bombardment continues.
Yep.
At 10 to 6 in the morning, USS Texas fires on the American sector of Omaha Beach. At 5 to 6, 329 British Liberator bombers start attacking German coastal positions. The scale of this, it's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? I mean, the big problem with the Liberators is, and the bombers coming over, is that they're attacking along the coast. They're attacking at 90 degrees to it. And so it's very difficult. You know, they're overcompensating because they don't want to drop on the invasion force.
Well, it is.
And so a lot of them come inland. But I would argue that's still not completely wasted time.
Sunrise, 2:56 on D-Day. The weather's grey. There's a swell. There's low clouds. Wind force is 3 to 4.
Which isn't so bad. That's choppy and kind of, you know, the occasional white top.
At 6 o'clock in the morning, I mean, another wave of bombers. American Marauders come in and drop.
Yeah, so these are twin engine bombers.
Drop 4,404 bombs. So 4,400 tons. Is it 400 tons of bombs? I can't do the maths. They drop a load of bombs on the Norman coast. Yeah. At the same time, 6th Fallschirmjäger Regiment have captured some paratroops around Carentan, and they're talking to them, interrogating them. But, you know,
asking them nicely.
What is happening? There is an invasion, you know, is this the invasion? You know.
Yeah. Number 56412.
Yeah, exactly. And even if they tell them, I mean, what difference does it make?
Yeah.
3rd Parachute Squadron RE blow up the bridge at...
Robom.
At Robom. So the bridges, the far west bridges, the far eastern bridges... Over the Dive and been dealt with.
I mean, the airborne operations go really well.
They go really, really well. And I think the really interesting thing is it's lots of small raiding operations all bundled into one big thing. Airborne soldiers are really good for is these mini targeted things. It's when you're trying to do...
Too much.
Or when you're trying to attack somewhere with a battalion, it gets a lot more difficult.
But if you go and blow up a bridge...
If you're going to blow up bridges, if you're taking out batteries...
Wins.
Exactly. If it's all ink spot, focused ink spots, it'll work later in the year, where taking the eye off their ball on that. But yeah, it all goes very well, and it's all, and a lot of it's to do with a high level of training, a high level of focus, and also, I mean, it's interesting. Gale briefs, the way he briefs 6th Airborne Division, everyone knows what's going to happen. Everyone knows all of the plan. So that when a SAPR officer turns up in the middle of the night and goes, I'm afraid I'm going to have to take your Jeep, I've got a bridge to blow up, and you're a medic, you don't tell him to get knotted. Yeah. You say, of course, absolutely, carry on. Because everyone knows every element of what they're, everyone in 6th Airborne has been briefed on what they've got to do.
Yep.
And what the division's doing as a whole, and then what individual parts are doing. As and I think that's really, really interesting. You know, it's not siloed, it's not sealed off knowledge. It's an open planning approach.
Yeah. 6:15 landing craft off British and Canadian sectors. So that's Sword, Juno, and Gold. Yep. They're starting to move in because it takes time. They're not landing till 7:30, but it takes time to get those landing craft off.
Get them in.
They've got to kind of lure them onto the sea. Yeah, then they've got
chalks,
They've all got to beetle around in circles until they're all ready to go in together. Yeah. So all that takes time. You know, more and more reports coming in all the time now from the various from the 716th, 352nd German divisions, and so it goes on. And then at 6:27 a.m. Omaha Beach, the end of the barrage bombardment of the coast by the offshore naval guns. And at 6:29, beach landings at Omaha begin. That's where we're going to leave it.
That's where we're going to
leave it. We've done the airborne drop. But I think it's interesting doing that way, because what you're starting to sense is this kind of, it's all kicking off. And from the German point of view, it's extremely confusing to start off with. Yeah. They're starting, you know, mounting, increasingly getting a picture of what's going on. Lots of information coming from all over the place. You know, you've got airborne troops in the east, you've got air troops in the west, on the Koh Tan Tan. No one knows quite what's going on. It's absolute mayhem. But what you also get a sense of is the kind of complexity of the Allied plan and the multi-layered nature of it. You know, air, land and sea and airborne and, you know, amphibious assaults.
Distraction effort and everything. I mean, it is literally, it's everything everywhere all at once. Germans not only have to figure out what's going on, what can they actually do? Yeah. Which fire do you put out? Once you've sent those guys off on bicycles, how do you get them back? The whole thing, firing a flare to get the ships to identify themselves. Yeah, yeah. The sort of depth of the confusion. You want that. That's a necessary effect of a landing, but the Germans are really they're offering confusion to the Allies in this situation, aren't they?
Yeah, they absolutely are.
So there you go, up to the start of the landings at Omaha Beach. Thank you very much for listening. If you like this kind of chat and you want to go to hang around in a bucolic English country setting, not far from Silverstone Racetrack, Blackpit Brewery, and you meet fellow like-minded people who are interested in this subject, come to We Have Ways Fest, 18th to the 21st of July, where you can see James and I doing this in the wild with tanks and aircraft and
going wild.
And going wild and beer and entertainment and all that sort of stuff. This will be our fourth We Have Ways Fest, and can you believe it? The thing's going to head of steam, and if you go to the website, buy a ticket. It is the ideal weekend for either your love of war waffling, or the war waffler in your life, or the person yet to become
a war waffler.
So
he doesn't even know yet.
Doesn't even know yet. Wehavewaysfest.co.uk. Brainwash your children with us. We'll see you very soon. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Cheerio.